Hi, folks. Welcome to Afternoon Wednesday Craft Brewers Conference 2019. Welcome, and thank you so much for being here. My name is Andy Sparhawk. I'm the content editor for craftbeer.com and the Brewers Association. A couple of housekeeping notes. You've heard them all week. Questions, if we get questions, hopefully, at the end, please use the mics in the front right here. We're recording it, so it'd be great to come back around to this sort of information at a later time, but also it's difficult for everybody to hear your question when you ask it. The other thing is very important, and the point that I want to come across is I don't recall many seminars covering this subject, and I think, you know, you're all in here because you recognize that this is becoming a more important topic than maybe we've considered in the past. So on your apps, the CBC apps, if you've downloaded them, make sure to use that feedback button to let the Brewers Association know that, you know, this was a good decision to make this or get the seminar going, and that we need more like this. I think it'll continue to be more and more important as we go down the line. So thank you all for being here. Obviously, this is mental health conditions in the workplace, and I'm going to kick it off to our speakers, Dr. Cindy Parsons and Jacqueline Garman. Please give them a warm welcome and a round of applause.
Welcome, and thank you for joining me and my colleague Cindy Parsons, an associate professor and mental health practitioner, today as we explore mental health conditions in the workplace. As a co-owner of a brewery and a psychotherapist, I live in two very different worlds. On the weekend, I may be pouring samples at a beer fest, and during the week, counseling individuals through life stressors while encouraging them to cut back on alcohol and educating on ways to cope positively with their stress. Coming into craft beer, I observed and guilty myself on occasion over consumption, but with mental health challenges related to craft beer industry stressors hit home, I began an exploration in how we, as members of the craft beer community and others, were dealing with similar challenges. Our goal today, as we explore the two most prevalent mental health conditions, depression and anxiety, is that we start a conversation about awareness and whatever our role in the craft beer industry, identify and learn ways to cope positively. I want to thank the individuals who took the time to learn I want to thank the individuals who took time to share their stories with me to better understand their challenges in the industry, and in some cases, how they have promoted mental health awareness and support within their own companies and communities. At the end of the presentation, we've included resources to organizations that offer ways to connect to help if needed. Thank you again for being here today as we break silence on mental health and craft beer. So depression in the workplace isn't just about having a bad day. Oftentimes, that's a misconception. It actually goes a lot deeper, and it's about negatively affecting how a person feels and thinks, and oftentimes decreases their ability to function at both work and at home. This is actually a list of a number of different symptoms that, as clinicians and mental health practitioners, we look at when we're looking at symptoms of depression. And I want to point out, I think it's really important that it's not that you only identify with maybe one, but for a person to actually be diagnosed with depression, a person not only has to be experiencing symptoms for more than 2 weeks, but they have to be experiencing them at least 5 or more. So we all experience sadness from time to time, and I don't know about you guys, but a lot of times energy for a lot of the stuff that we're involved in, I feel quite fatigued. But it's really about hitting all of those different categories, at least 5 or more, in order to actually have a diagnosis be made. But how does this actually translate to the workplace, and what can we be looking out for?
So for myself, I treat depression all the time, and as we were introduced, the two disorders we're going to talk about today are two of the most common disorders, recognizing that about 1 in 5 persons are affected. Can you hear me?
I don't think that mic's on.
Right. Okay. So, anyhow, the two disorders we're talking about today, anxiety and depression, affect about 1 in 5 people in the United States. So that's really prevalent. And so how do we recognize it at work? Depression can develop really acutely, or it can be more insidious and slow to develop. And then we have to start recognizing what are the factors that we're seeing in our employees. So things you would see are lack of interest, not showing up or not being attentive, being very distracted. And I know that that sounds weird for depression, but it is a really common sign of depression. We might have them not paying attention to assignments or not following through with appointments or not being as attentive to detail, or leaving early, coming in late. And so that becomes having an effect on, you know, the whole team. They might being very indecisive. So you give them something to do, or you're in a team meeting and you're asking for input and you're not getting a lot of interaction. So that can also affect, you know, your productivity within the workplace. Absenteeism, and for many of you, you work in small industries where you maybe have anywhere from 15 to 50 employees, and one person being absent can have a significant effect. And it, you know, one day is not bad, but if it's a day every week or a couple of days every week, it really starts having an effect. And not only on team interactions and team cohesiveness, but on the ability to get things followed through and done. So Jacqueline's going to talk a little bit more about some of the other signs.
So some of these also include detached and low motivation. And I think it's also really important to point out that a person may have actually been previously engaged in their work, and then suddenly there's a change in their functioning. That's really what you're wanting to be looking for, that they didn't just where you're noticing that whether it be change in appearance, they usually came to work kind of pulled together, and suddenly they're coming to work looking a little disheveled. But it has to, you know, you want to be able to see it like a consistent pattern, not just a one-off week. They're busy, they're trying to get out the door, but a consistent thing. And then inappropriate relations or reactions and strained relationships with those that they work with. Also being absent-minded or forgetful, Cindy kind of touched on that a little bit, but a person might seem scattered, very forgetful, and oftentimes they're lacking in their confidence as far as the work that they feel that they're able to put out. They're questioning their abilities oftentimes. So we're going to go ahead and look now at anxiety in the workplace, first looking at what anxiety is and then how that also can translate to our work.
So anxiety disorders are the most common mental illness that we see in the United States. And that being said, you know, there's a whole plethora, so we're not going to go into the specific diagnoses because we could spend the whole hour doing that. But what we'll see most commonly in the workplace is going to be generalized anxiety disorder, or that overall chronic feeling of anxiety or panic disorder. So those are the two most common. When we look at anxiety, it can be a lifelong illness. So it is helpful for employers to be able to recognize that and kind of direct their employees to the right place, you know, be it to get some kind of help, get evaluated, maybe get on some medication. So let's look at some of the symptoms of anxiety. So, and I'm sure all of us have experienced anxiety at one time in our lives, right? And you get that, you know, that chest tightening, your heart pounding, you're sweating. So that is really acute anxiety. A person with general anxiety is going to feel that to a lesser degree chronically, so all the time, with exacerbations at other times. So when they're a little bit more stressed or they feel more pressure, maybe they've got multiple things going on at home, at work, financially, you're going to see those acute exacerbations.
So how we look at those in the workplace is, with anxiety, a lot of times individuals will feel reluctant to actually speak up in a meeting. You probably in the industry have a lot of work meetings, and you could have an individual who just chronically does not feel comfortable speaking up. I know I've had people disclose that to me, that I just don't really like talking in meetings. I get really anxious about it. They also might be reluctant to work in groups. They prefer to work a lot of times very individually, because it also goes back to this idea of having to speak up publicly. And then also we can sometimes see the constant worry of not meeting those deadlines. They might oftentimes be checking in with you because they're worried that they're not hitting that deadline. And so you can see that very frequently, and the worry that exists with that. In addition is fear of humiliation. And, of course, concern that they're being judged by the people that they work with, whether it be their boss or their colleagues. And constructive criticism. Constructive criticism is always very helpful for people navigating their jobs. But if a person has difficulty with it, sometimes that can be indicative of dealing with some anxiety. And then the excessive worry that it's not going to be up to par, that they're never going to be delivering work that's good enough for the company. They also can have difficulty interacting with authority figures, and then just committing to new tasks, or even going for a promotion, because it requires them to have to sort of step outside of the box and do something that feels new and uncomfortable, and they can feel very anxious about that.
So some other problems that we'll notice is, number one, that difficulty concentrating again, so really following through, or you feel like they're not paying attention to you. You having to give them, you know, the same instructions over and over again, and it's kind of frustrating, like, okay, I've talked to you already about this and what's going on. Excessive fatigue, real big problem. And again, there you're going to see leaving early or needing to take more frequent breaks. Their productivity, because of the need to check over and over again for mistakes, can be really bogged down. And then let's talk a little bit about, you can talk about social media and factors that can really impact or exacerbate these conditions.
Yeah, so social media is such a huge component about what we do in this industry. And I think what I really wanted to touch upon in relationship to social media, as well as the products that we use in social media, is how are we using them? So if we're using them in a way that promotes irresponsible drinking practices, that can certainly impact mental health or make it more difficult. And I think we do have to be really mindful that while we may be attempting to be humorous, we do have to be aware that we may inadvertently be minimizing real issues of alcoholism that can oftentimes have devastating effects on individuals and their families. The other thing that I wanted to point out is that lack of boundary setting related to work-life integration can really exacerbate mental health. I know my husband and I have 3 businesses. We have a 6-year-old, so there's a lot of juggling that goes on. And if we don't have really good, clear boundaries as we're kind of moving through those different roles that we wear in our life, it can really affect how we feel. So it's important that we take the time to sort of reset and create those boundaries for ourselves. And I think that's important that we do this in our industry as well, just because of the nature of what we do. It's sometimes we're not emergency room doctors, but I do feel like our industry is very 24/7. I know that when we're going out to events, sometimes we have 3 or 4 pre-events before we get to the big event. And so just really checking in with ourselves and having those boundaries. And then I included at the very corner, I came across this in a beer group that I'm in, and I saw it, and what jumped out to me is, this is a consumer, not someone in our industry per se, but they were pointing out that they were happy that we make drinking more about it being a neat hobby than more than the alcoholism. And so that's what I was sort of kind of touching on, that it is important that we have an understanding of what our role is in the industry, because we do have consumers that love our products and love what we do, but we certainly don't want to minimize those people that are truly impacted by issues of alcoholism and mental health problems. All right, so other behaviors that can impact. When I was doing some of my pre-interviews, I had a person in the industry who said, I'm in my 40s and I feel like at this point, I have dealt with more peer pressure in my 40s than I have in high school. And she was actually talking about sometimes feeling like the pressure to drink more can sometimes be intense. And I really appreciated her kind of opening up to that, because I've been in that situation. I've put water in a beer can to make it look like I'm drinking just so I don't have to hear, oh, Jackie, why aren't you drinking more, just because I don't have to deal with it. But I think we have to be aware of that. You know, if you are the person that's saying it, be aware of how we're, when we're checking in with people, we might unintentionally be adding to the peer pressure that does exist. And then the actual shaming that has been mentioned at times and talking with people in the industry, feeling that sometimes they feel that if they're, you know, they're not drinking, oh, why aren't you drinking? And that can sometimes make people feel like, well, I don't really want, feel like I have to tell you why I'm not drinking. But they may be making that choice for themselves for a variety of reasons. So just being aware of that. And then the social acceptance of the way that we just decompress. So what I find really interesting, of course, in my other job as a psychotherapist, my way of decompressing is hopping in my car, turning on the radio or a podcast, and decompressing on my 30-minute commute home. In our industry, for a lot of people, they walk out of the brewery and into the tasting room. We do have a social acceptance, or it's socially acceptable in our industry to decompress that way. So I think that we do have to be aware of particularly how we decompress. Shift beers are great, but is it something that's getting to a point where people are using that as their only way to decompress? And then, of course, overconsumption. For anyone that's been to beer festivals, we can kind of talk about that in a whole nother conversation, but overconsumption is oftentimes a challenge for a lot of people in trying to balance all of that. And thankfully, a lot of the festivals and events, we oftentimes have water, but overconsumption can certainly impact mental health. And Cindy's going to talk to us about how alcohol can impact depression and anxiety.
So I'm going to really just touch on not the typical occasional or social drinking, but really the effect of alcohol on people with the depression or anxiety and how that can exacerbate their illnesses, because that's where we, you know, have a little bit of touchy ground, because it does have an effect. Alcohol is a central nervous system depressant. So somebody that's already dealing with depression is going to have more acute symptomatology, or they're going to become more depressed. And as we all know, like, that first drink is a bit relaxing, so you get a little bit of euphoria. It's as you can continue to consume that you get that effect of the depressant. And so you can see it playing a role. And one of the things Jacqueline and I talked about is, you know, we have to be very cognizant of people who have a tendency towards self-harm, suicidal ideation. And when we look at some of the more visible or current suicides that we've had in the media, you know, when you dig down, these people had significant substance issues going on with them. So we really do have some responsibility to figuring it out, or, you know, trying to be aware of it within our workplace and within our employee workforce. You know, one of the things that most people kind of find awkward or uncomfortable is, okay, well, what do I do? You know, I know that person's depressed. At times they've talked about, like, life would be better off, you know, if I wasn't here being a burden to my family or whatever. I just want to encourage you all to that taking action is the best thing to do. It is so difficult, and when we were talking, I'm like, you know, yeah, I still struggle with it at times when I've got a patient in my office. Okay, how am I going to feel if I have to send that person to the hospital? Well, you know, and I do a lot of work with young people in our student health center, and one of the things is, you know, I, like, have to have a heart-to-heart with them and say, look, I would feel 100 times worse if I didn't do this action, because I don't know what's going to happen in the next 24 hours, but I know that I'm going to try to get you to a place where you're going to be safe, maybe you're not intoxicated anymore, and we can see things in a better light, you know, the next day. So that with depression, it is really, really a very fine line. Alcohol is disinhibiting, so that means that your impulse control is lessened. If you're a person that's more prone to seeing things in a negative light, then you tend to exaggerate that. And so this isn't the time where you want to, like, give them the opportunity to make the best decision, because they're not going to. With anxiety, alcohol actually can become a bigger problem. So for some folks, especially when I was talking about generalized anxiety, you know, you're kind of feeling like that chronic tension all the time. So you go, you have a drink, and it's like, oh, my God, I don't feel that way now. And so then you have another drink, and maybe another drink. And that can then become a sticky wicket because it's like, okay, now I've developed a self-medicating habit. I can manage my anxiety as long as I have a drink. And so then it becomes that negative feedback loop because I'm okay if I drink rather than really getting to the root cause. And you know, in my industry, we don't prescribe alcohol. We prescribe benzodiazepines. And I have the same problem with patients with the benzodiazepines because it's a quick fix. And it gives them that quick relief from the symptoms, but it doesn't ever get to the root cause. And anxiety disorders are really quite treatable. So, you know, it is incumbent upon us to really, like, look at that and start being aware of, hey, if my employee has a problem, maybe I just need to be the person. I've got a list of resources, and I can kind of suggest to them that I'm seeing some stuff come up, and I'm not, you know, the professional. So let me give you some resources to look at. Lastly, with alcohol, and especially with overconsumption, one of the things we see as our bodies start metabolizing alcohol is that you actually go through mini withdrawals. So when we think about withdrawal, we typically think about a long-term heavy alcohol user. But any time you consume over that 0.08, the next day your body's going to go through mini withdrawals. And, you know, it's quite interesting, but the feelings that it gives you physiologically are feelings of anxiety. And so you kind of get into that dog chasing the tail modality. So I talked a little bit about the treatment risks and self-medicating. The other thing I want to touch on is if a person is using any kind of antidepressant. So the antidepressants we use actually do treat both anxiety and depression. So it kind of gets, you know, when I'm trying to prescribe to a person that with depression, they're good. But if it's an anti-anxiety thing, then they're like, no, I'm not depressed. I'm just anxious. So they really do both. They work for both disorders. Alcohol, while it may not negate completely the effect of the antidepressant, it certainly does have a negative impact on it and can have some significant drug and substance interactions. So with medications like Zoloft or Prozac, we can see that exaggerating the effects of alcohol. The benzodiazepines, on the other hand, are also CNS depressants, and so the combination of the two can be quite deadly.
Okay, so we're going to be talking a little bit about stigma and defining what is actually stigma. There's actually six different types of stigma, but for the purpose of mental health, we're going to look at two of them, which is the social and public stigma and the self-perceived stigma. So when we look at stigma, it's actually derived from the Latin and Greek words to mean a mark or a brand. And I think that's really important because oftentimes when you talk with people privately about mental health in general, and then when you get even more finite and talk about it in the craft beer industry, a lot of people don't really feel like they want to open up, and they do feel very much like, I don't want to be marked or branded as someone who's got this problem. Oops. I'm jumping ahead here. There you go. All right, so knowledge among the public regarding mental health problems is poor, and negative beliefs and attitudes are widespread. Misconceptions include that mental health problems are actually uncommon, that individuals impacted by mental health conditions never recover, and that treatment is ineffective. This is not true. And in the workplace, for employers, it's a misconception that anxiety and depression can cause an undue hardship on the business. But the reality is, if treated, these disorders actually have a far better outcome than many people realize. And when we look at specifically social and public stigma, they are very much characterized by these two different points here, prejudicial. Like, need water. And discriminating behavior focused on individuals. With actual mental health problems due to the psychiatric label that they've been given. And we're really big believers on, thank you, I appreciate that. We're really big believers on not labeling people. I do always like to say has a mental health condition versus defining the person by what their diagnosis is. I think that's important to help with that. And then we have the self-stigma. So in a self-stigma, it's a person with an undesired condition is actually aware of the public stigma about their condition, but then that person may begin to agree with those negative public stereotypes that are true about the group, even though that's not actually the case. And then the person concurs that these stereotypes apply to them, and it can lead to actual harm, to significant decreases in self-esteem and self-efficacy, which is in one's belief in one's ability to actually be successful in specific situations or be able to actually accomplish a task. And Cindy's going to actually go over why it is an issue and cover a couple of points related to why stigma is a problem.
Go back to that slide, because I really like the statement that Jacqueline put in there. It's so important because we really do, and persons with mental illness do really, they're very harshly critical of themselves, and oftentimes will see themselves as being not worthy. When you go back and look at the symptoms of depression, there's a lot of guilt, a lot of hopelessness and helplessness involved in it. And so we really need to start, you know, being a kinder, gentler nation to ourselves and not be so hard on ourselves. So why is stigma an issue? And it's funny. I mean, I don't probably look as old as I am, but I've been in mental health for a really long time, and then my family prior to that was in mental health. And, you know, we really have not changed the talk or the dialogue about mental health. You know, we don't talk about somebody with diabetes or somebody with heart disease as negatively as we talk about depression and anxiety. And yet when you look at the financial impact that it has on productivity, it has about the same impact as cardiovascular disease. So, you know, it is treatable, and let's start having that kind of dialogue rather than sticking our head in the sand or closing our eyes to it. People feel ashamed. You're not going to go out and tell, although some of my patients do, oh, I'm going to go see my shrink today. But most people don't do that.
I think it is generational. Like, we do see younger people.
Younger people seem to be a little bit more open about that. My older clients tend to, avoid eye contact if we meet in a public place. But denial can be the biggest thing. So if I don't seek help, if I don't acknowledge the disease, I don't have the disease, and then therefore I avoid being stigmatized. So now we're going to get into the meat of the discussion and look at kind of what our responsibility is within the workplace and things we can do.
Yeah, so the title of an article I came across in the Huffington Post read, "Let's call mental health stigma what it really is, discrimination." Unfortunately, the reality is discrimination does occur due to the societal outlook that we have on mental health, resulting in behavior and policy that actually makes our life more difficult for those people living with mental health challenges. But we do have protection against discrimination. And Cindy and I were discussing how we kind of feel like this could be an hour-long conversation. So we won't be spending a great deal of time. We have a slide dedicated to it. But it is a really important conversation to talk about discrimination, because discrimination does happen with respect to mental health. And so the first thing that I want to talk about is the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, which some of you may be familiar with. But it's a federal law that prohibits discrimination against job applicants and employees with disabilities. And this specific law that was actually introduced relatively, from a policy perspective, very late in the game in 2000, and then later an amendment was added in 2008. So we're not talking that long ago where we actually put in a policy or an act to protect Americans with disabilities. But it only applies to private employers with more than 15 employees and state and local government employers. And then we have the Family Medical Leave Act. Oftentimes, the FMLA, a lot of people associate with pregnancy. I don't know about anybody else, but that's usually the association that a lot of people get. I'm going to take medical leave to go have a kid. But the Family Medical Leave Act is actually a act that allows people to be able to take up to 12 weeks of unpaid, emphasis on unpaid, leave in the event of an illness to help care for a family member or for themselves. The law actually permits you to take a leave of absence while preserving your job placement and the benefits. The FMLA only applies to employers with more than 50 employees, and you, in order to actually qualify for FMLA, you have to be at the company for a minimum of 12 months for that same employer. So our company has 10 people who work, we have 10 employees. I think that can sometimes be very challenging to navigate from a protection standpoint for smaller businesses, and so for individuals that are working within smaller companies. So that's where you'd also want to be checking with your state law regarding state-specific laws that protect employees from discrimination. And if you've ever felt like you've been discriminated against, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is an organization that actually enforces the ADA. So if an employer is covered by the ADA, then you can actually file a complaint with them. And also, if your state has laws similar to ADA, they would be actually enforced by the Fair Employment Protection Agency. So again, I want to reiterate, I think it's very important for employers who are in the hiring process to know that depression and anxiety does not typically place an undue hardship on your business. And awareness of mental health should not encourage employees to reconsider hiring practices. All right, so what is our responsibility exactly in CRAFT? What should we be focusing on, or why is it important that we be talking about this? And Cindy kind of mentioned economic. But here's a list of what we would refer to as indirect costs that an organization incurs when we're not addressing mental health, and that includes loss of productivity. Cindy mentioned presenteeism, but the same would go for absenteeism. Absenteeism as well, but presenteeism is if the person's there but they're not doing the work, the work's not happening, as well as the disability claims. And the legal implications, I think, are really important here, too. I know I was talking to a brewery owner, and in the early days when they started, they didn't really have any policies about drinking. People could just hop behind the bar and get themselves a beer, and they realized over time that that was putting themselves at great legal risk. So their entire livelihood that was put into the company could be greatly impacted if one of their employees left without having policies in place to oversee that. So in addition to policies that would impact drinking behavior, it also, you know, helps kind of help people have boundaries in the workplace. All right, and so the social impact, our responsibilities involve cultivating a culture that reinforces and promotes the healthy coping strategies and encourages and reinforces responsible drinking practices, and we'll talk in the next couple of slides about how we can do that as employers. And the reason why we want to do that is because the reality is, if we're not doing that, we are impacting family systems, and we want to be able to impact them positively and not put additional stressors on the individual and their families. But we also want to promote CRAFT in a positive way. I think we have a responsibility to do that. We want to make sure that we're decreasing our legal issues, because that can become very costly as well. But I think more importantly, we all care about one another, and I think it's important that we do this because we want to maintain healthy mental health to ensure that we're decreasing our suicide rates, because it certainly helps by having this type of culture. All right, so how do we achieve mental health wellness in our companies? It starts from the top. I'm sure we have some employers in the room. We also have employees. But I really truly feel that it starts from the top. So it's really about modeling and leading by example. And that might be in the form of practicing self-care for ourselves. How are we taking care of ourselves? Are we putting our phone in Do Not Disturb and taking a moment to kind of like take a break for ourselves? Or are we constantly on the go 24/7 responding to everything? And I know it's really hard too, especially depending on the size of your brewery. You might be doing multiple jobs, but it really is important that you're leading by example and taking care of yourself in that. Also important is the policies that we create. So I'm speaking from the perspective of starting a brewery, and I want to. I thought I heard mention that there's a lot of smaller breweries represented for the first time at the BA. Like we have a lot more this year represented. And in talking with other brewery owners who have been open for a couple of years, they said, you know, Jacqueline, we just started writing our policies. Like we just started working on our SOPs, and you can't blame them, because if you're running a brewery, you have 1,000 other things that you're trying to take care of. And oftentimes things like SOPs can sometimes get put by the wayside to put out fires, fix equipment, you know, whatever it is that you're trying to keep your business afloat. Policies can sometimes become like a something that's placed on the back burner, but it is really important that as we're thinking about policies, about you know, not missing work, but that we're also talking about promoting mental health, wellness, and what are those policies going to look like. Connecting with your guild, I think every state has a guild. I know in our state, in Florida, Sean Norquist, our executive director of the guild, is doing some work right now to hopefully get some health insurance available, because I think that's oftentimes one of the challenges, too, that hasn't really been hit upon. The access to healthcare is a huge problem in the United States, and a lot of people will say, well, how can I achieve that? So I know in particular our guild is working to help with that, so your guild may be a resource to be able to help with different things to help promote mental health wellness and give your employees or yourself access to mental health. And then empower your employees to seek resources. That might mean that you have to be sort of aware of what is available in your community and kind of get to know what the community has to offer as far as resources that would help them be able to achieve mental health awareness. And then I find that the best way, and this could be the social worker in me and talking with people, it's all about networking, connecting. I think we all know how to do that when we want to talk about beers, but we can also talk about, you know, how do you guys deal with this particular challenge in relationship to mental health, and how are you addressing that within your organization? Some of the companies out there are already doing it, and they have some really great ideas, whether it be EAPs that they've put into place to assist employees with mental health, by offering them so many sessions available to be able to address their mental health needs. I think Cindy and I were actually talking about Talkspace and Headspace as being an option that a lot of organizations are utilizing to get access for employees.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about employees and how employees can kind of work on their own mental well-being, and that practicing self-care. So Jacqueline addressed that from the employer perspective, but look at yourself as an employee, because even if you're the owner, you're an employee. How many of you practice self-care? And how many of you know what good self-care is? Not too many, right? We are in such a connected world, and we are always on our, you know, on our phones, checking our email, checking our social media, and we really need to take time to disconnect. I was sharing with Jacqueline, one of my former clients is a business person, and actually was talking about going on vacation in the upcoming week. And, you know, I don't know how many of you do this, but I'm a little bit guilty of it, but you're looking at, oh, now I'm leaving for vacation on Saturday, and it's now Thursday, and you find the 50,000 things that you haven't done that you really need to get done before you leave on vacation. We need to be able to recognize that even if we put that on the back burner for the next week, it's probably not going to be life and death. So to be able to disconnect, you know, and that means when you're done at the end of the day, you're done at the end of the day. I'm a healthcare professional. We are the worst people about doing that. We take care of our patients for 8, 10, 12 hours a day. We go home, we worry about them. We're, you know, responding to calls from them. We need to be able to disconnect. And in today's younger generation, they don't get it. They don't, like, realize, like, you're not on call 24/7 just because they have a little crisis. And their crises usually aren't real crises, you know. So, you know, doing things like managing our physical health, getting out and enjoying nature, making sure you get enough sleep, making sure you eat appropriately because, you know, I'm looking around and there's a lot of good, you know, carbs out here, but we got to have a good balance with our diets, making sure you keep yourself hydrated. And then having a network. And yes, your coworkers are a good network, but you need to have balance in your life and have other people outside of your job as being your social network so that you can get some objectivity and balance in your life. So if you are an employee and you do have issues or you have colleagues that, you know, kind of confide in you that they are experiencing mental health issues, help them to seek resources or refer them to your employer. You know, it is also your responsibility to have your manager know that somebody's not doing well. So you also has a friend, a colleague, want to be able to have that environment where people feel open, so where we're decreasing the stigma. Help them to know that they can talk about their, what you know, whatever, their symptoms or their worries, their concerns, their fear of being stigmatized in the workplace. But you don't want it to become like a bitch session. So that's not what that's meant to be. It's meant to be an open, welcoming, supportive environment.
We were both doing that.
Yeah.
I've got it.
Okay.
Yeah. And then finally, so we really want to be able to support our coworkers and encourage them to seek help. Cindy kind of touched on it. We do this for a living, and it's really hard for us to have to sometimes make that call when we reach out and have to have someone, we call it in Florida a Baker Act, a BA-52. It could differ for different states. But if someone is in danger, it is really important that you pick up the phone and get help for them. At the end of the day, them living is a lot more important than maybe pissing them off in that moment. You also want to be able to listen without judgment and be able to offer support. Again, we're trained to be able to do this. But really, it is about listening, the emphasis on listening. A lot of times, people just want to be heard. And by being able to listen without judgment, you're offering them support. And then finally, and I'm going to end this slide about self-care. It really is that we encourage one another for self-care. I know outside of work, I reach out to my girlfriends to grab coffee, and we do our self-care together sometimes. Maybe we go work out. Whatever it is, encourage one another. You know, that's what we're all here for. To be sort of supportive with one another and help each other when we're really struggling. And then finally, there we go. I was like, where'd it go? So we were sort of talking this morning about, it's anecdotal. I haven't researched it yet. But it is kind of curious that men, when I'm in sessions with men and we talk about self-care, I'm not going to generalize too much here, because I do have to look up the research, but I do find in a lot of my sessions with my gentlemen that they really struggle with coming up with self-care ideas. So I like this wheel because it identifies the different areas within our lives, the physical, psychological, emotional, spiritual, personal, and professional areas in which we can implement some self-care habits and for some reason, I don't usually have a hard time developing self-care habits with my women clients, but I do think a lot of times that does come from this idea, and we were talking about how, you know, I can't stop what I'm doing, I have to go work, like this idea that, you know, men are constantly working and we can't put our stuff down. But the reality is we all, whatever our gender, we all need to develop self-care habits. So we end on self-care because I find that it's the most important when dealing with mental health. But the reality is it truly is about taking small steps. We don't have to take leaps in order to have better mental health wellness. And it starts with this self-care that we've talked about in closing with. So we're going to end there. because I think we have about 15 minutes. Yeah, 3:22.
Yeah. Let's go over the, let's just show them the resources.
Oh, yeah. So if you, yeah, there we go. So here's a couple of different support options. NIMH, the National Institute for Mental Health, has some really great, like they have a sort of like a find, like you can plug in your state and zip code and that sort of stuff, and it'll pull up information. NAMI, I really love NAMI. They have some really great articles and information about specific diagnoses in more detail if you want to read more about it. And then, of course, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline that you can reach out. They do have a telephone number, although I did list the actual link to the website. And then one of my favorite organizations, they're based out of Florida in Melbourne, is called To Write Love on Her Arms. And they're a phenomenal organization. They oftentimes partner with bands, but they do a lot of work in suicide prevention. And then you can always go to your state or county government and search your health department to see what available resources are in your community. And Psychology Today, so we didn't get to dive into healthcare in relationship to mental health, because that could be another topic for another day. But Psychology Today is a great resource because it does offer clinicians, whether they take insurance or we refer to them as taking cash therapists, so you can find therapists in your community. You can plug in specifically what type of help you're looking for, whether you're dealing with anxiety, you can plug that in, and it'll pull up clinicians specifically in your area that you can go to. And a lot of times they will list like their fees and stuff like that. And then if you're really bored, you can check out the additional references that I have for y'all. Do you guys have any questions? And where is the mic? Oh, there it is.
The mic's on either side.
Does anybody have any questions?
Comments? Something we didn't talk about? Okay. Awesome.
Are we on?
I think it's on.
I got to talk close to it? Okay, great. I just wanted to say that thank you for doing this. I think this is amazing. And I was definitely someone before who had that judgment, stigma, when I would hear that people were like suffering from depression or suffering from anxiety. And so it's okay to have that like judgy thing going on in your head. But just to put it out there, my daughter was diagnosed with depression and anxiety about 3 weeks ago and by a psychiatrist, and she's on medication, and it is life-changing. I mean, life-changing. So if you know someone, I just want to put it out there, if you know someone that you suspect is suffering from it, or if you're personally suffering from it, get help. Like, seriously, it's a med. It's like having diabetes or something. And now I just, like, I'm a huge ambassador for it now, because I just want people to know that it can change your world. I mean, you can be functional. Or the person you used to be. Like, I have conversations with her like she used to be. So I just want to say, if you know someone, do it. And think of it like a physical illness, like you broke your arm or something.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm done with the judgy. I'm a huge ambassador. I appreciate
you
doing it.
Yeah, thank
but
you.
The meds are life-changing. It's, like, super cool. So thank you for it.
Yeah, and thank you.
Tough to follow up after that. But we've covered anxiety and depression. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering what you guys have to help with anger. Like, I'm not sure if everyone else here finds our job stressful, but, like, I fucking rage, and it's horrible for my other employees and customers and whatnot. If I'm there throwing a glass against a wall or a fucking pot, like, I shouldn't be doing it. So, like,
that's
how,
true.
How are there any hints or tips you have that, not to cure
for anger,
anger
management?
People get angry.
Aside from
just,
the
like,
movie.
Not the
you know
normal
what?
Of count to ten.
Anger is actually oftentimes an underlying symptom of depression. Mm-hmm. But also with anxiety, and especially as that tension escalates, because believe me, I work with like seriously mentally ill people, and one of the things we have to learn about verbal de-escalation is that when somebody's at that state, you don't try to reason with them, because their anxiety has gone through the roof. So, you know, learning how to de-escalate your own anxiety is the most important thing to do.
Counting.
Maybe you work with some of your close employees to have them give you cue words, you know, because you'll see it happening, you know, and as you get in tune with yourself, you can kind of know, okay, whoa, I need to go take a time out.
Yeah, because it you have to develop the awareness, but it sounds like you have an awareness, so that's actually a really good start.
Yeah. All right.
That is. That's the beginning. That's the beginning, awareness. You're welcome.
Hi. I was talking to a colleague of mine the other day, and this was a very stressful period for me at work, and so she asked me about it, we talked about it, and she asked me the question, like, at the job, do we really have, like, a space to talk about those things? Because, like, we think we're open people, we're in a very festive industry, and we like to get together, but when would be the good time to really point out those kind of stuff? Do you have tips you can give to management for that kind of thing?
I'm going to mention. I think, again, it starts from the top up, but I also think I've been an employee in my, walks in life, and I think it's about speaking up too and saying, hey, we have this need here within our company. Before I got into private practice, I actually worked in death and dying. And of course, that particular field requires a lot of check-ins and support and like a community little forum type of thing. And we sort of developed our own model of a weekly team meeting to see how things are going for all of us. You know, it's really about what are the company needs and what do people want to have available to them.
I think the same thing. I think, we typically have our staff meetings and feel like that's about the business, but, it can be a good time to set aside, 15, 20 minutes to just talk about, how are people feeling and how are things going, and do that kind of self-care within that. Or maybe setting aside, a monthly time where you all get together and do something fun so that you are de-stressing.
Yeah, and I had I don't think he's here, but I had a second to talk to Chris Heron of Creature Comforts, and we were sort of talking about mental health and, what do you guys do at Creature Comforts? And again, this goes back to talk to other companies, and maybe we need to be doing that within the industry more, creating a forum for us to sort of talk about this. But one of the things that I really like that he mentioned that they do is town hall meetings. So they have developed that within their company that sort of provides a forum for people to talk about the stuff that they're dealing with. Because a lot of us, we're at work a lot, and it's important that we learn how to work through our stuff and support one another.
And I just want to throw out there that one of the things that we can do that's probably the best thing we can do is to catch people doing good. Create some positivity and give positive feedback to each other. Because we all work our butts off all the time. And so, how many of us go around patting ourselves on the back? No. But if you can start setting a tone of that, that's a really great way to help de-stress.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So my question is, how would you implement kind of a system within your brewery or within I guess your workplace, just your workplace, I suppose, to implement positive conversations and really open that up for people to be able to, you have customers that are sitting at the bar, and sometimes they're just there to talk. What are some ways to kind of implement some of that positivity that you're implementing with your employees to also kind of feed out into the customers? And I know as a beer tender, it would be very difficult for me to be in a position where it's like, oh, wow, you just dropped a big bomb. Now what? So what are some steps that you would recommend going forward to prepare your employees for conversations like that?
Do you want to...
Wow, that one's a toughie. Because number one, you have to have some boundaries with it because you don't want to become the person that everybody comes in and dumps on.
That can be a huge responsibility to take on. That could be a big responsibility to take on.
Yeah, but you can also, give some positive feedback like, hey, wow, it sounds like you had a really bad day. I'm sorry nobody recognized it for you, and thank you for sharing. But also, you might want to say, hey, who at work gives you positivity? How do you fill your own well? Because you're not the place that they need to be doing that. Who's
so
in their family?
Boundaries.
Who's their support system?
Yeah, creating those boundaries for yourself, but
yeah,
offering
other suggestions.
And knowing those resources, you know. Hey, you know, I heard of a running group that, you know, meets up every Thursday. Do you have any interest in that, or a cycling group or something like that? So help them find some other outlets, you know.
I wanted to clarify, you were saying in a beer tender role and people dumping on you?
It's pretty much like within your work, within your workplace. I know
like customers are unveiling a bunch of stuff. Is that what you're talking about?
There could be situations like that.
Okay.
But
I get that.
I'm talking more on like the preparing people within your workplace to be at a place to.
So there's actually a really good book that I would recommend, and it's called Crucial Conversations, because those are really crucial conversations, and knowing how to manage them and knowing how to refer them is really, really important.
Okay.
So, yeah, and I think, you know, using those town halls like Jacqueline suggested, that's a good opportunity. We do a lot in counseling. We call it peer supervision.
Yeah.
So we talk about, you know, okay, this is how I handled that situation. Anybody got some feedback?
Okay.
So create that within your own work environment.
Yeah, because I do know that we don't have an HR department. Like, most small businesses don't have an HR department. So I think, you know, it does become very challenging sometimes, because in bigger companies, if there's an issue like that erupts, it goes right to HR and they help handle it and walk you through all of that. So.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Hi there. We have a long-term employee, really highly valued, who helps run a small department in our brew pub in one of the kitchens there. And he becomes visibly depressed maybe 3 times a year, maybe, I'm just saying on an average, 3 times a year. So his personality will change from just, I mean, he comes to work and he's effective, but he's not social, he's totally shut down. And so he and I have conversations about what's going on, you know, try to find him, you know, offer him counsel, you know, find counselors and do all that for him, so supporting him. But his team, they, you know, that's, you know, it's like he comes to work and they're like, what's wrong with him? You know, how, you know, he's not talking to me today, and how do you, and it's a personal thing. He's a very close friend that works in the department, understands what's going on with him, but it's also still frustrating for him, even being that close with him. So how do you, you know, it's just such a fine balance that's, his personality is going to change, and I just want to be able to support them and support him at the same time.
You know, I mean, you're not his counselor, but that's what he needs, because one of the things I do with my clients is to teach them, like, you got to know what you look like when you're not on, you know, when you're not doing well, because that's when you need to go and be seeing a counselor, getting yourself care, or maybe getting back on medication, or upping. I mean, I have patients who, like, they, and all of us do this, you know, we do really good about our exercise, and then we slack. So finding out what are those things that pull me out of it, and that's his responsibility. And, you know, it's just like any chronic illness, you got to manage it. It's not everybody else's responsibility to manage it for you. So when you start showing symptoms, what are you going
to
do?
Yeah, the individual does have to become responsible, but we as employers also have to be able to provide outlets too.
So provide outlets, you mean providing with resources?
The resources, yeah. Yeah, and again, like, it does become a little bit of a sticky situation. But again, if you're providing resources and acknowledging, hey, I realize that you're going through this, here's information, as an employer, you're also protecting yourself too, because you are aware. Just like if it were a broken arm, you know, they need help as well, and you're not ignoring the issue. And then again, it goes back to policy and talking about implementing policy that talks about mental health and how are we handling this within our company and making it about the culture of the company and what we do in these situations.
Yeah, maybe I could dig a little bit deeper, because if he did have a broken arm, or if he was going into a insulin state of a coma or something, people would be aware of this health issue. But because you don't really talk about his...
Right.
It's more difficult. It's,
yeah, and it sounds like some people are taking it personal. Not realizing that it's...
But that's what we talked about right at the beginning, is how that can have an effect on organizational culture, the social issues, and the economic impact. So that was a great example.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
You have a question? Comment?
Yeah, I just want to thank you both and the whole panel, first of all, for putting this together. We don't have this conversation nearly enough in the industry, and hopefully we can continue to have it and on a bigger and larger scale. So thank you both for giving this presentation. I'm also curious, I'm not an owner of a brewery. I'm an employee, and I love my job. But sometimes our ownership and our management, they're very busy people, and this is a hard thing to sit down and really talk about with them. And, we have a hard time meeting as is about day-to-day stuff. So do you have any tips or suggestions for how to go back and talk with them about, hey, because I work with a lot of other employees, and I know that people have things that they'd like to air out. But do you have any tips for maybe going back and talking to ownership or management and kind of putting this on the radar?
That depends on your relationship with ownership. Yeah. But if you have a decent relationship, it's like one of those things where find the time, like make the appointment rather than trying to do it in the middle of a busy day, and be able to say, hey, this is just something that's on my radar, and I wanted to share with you that there's kind of some stuff going on, and can we have some opportunities to talk about it? Most people are really receptive to it. They're just so darn busy that it doesn't become a priority.
Yeah, because it may not be something that they see affecting them at the end of the day. But it does.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. It does affect everybody.
Yeah, totally. And I work in sales, so I'm not around a lot of the time.
Yeah.
That's another thing, too, where we're a lot of times very isolated from the brewery and the culture, and that's another thing where we work independently a lot, and, we talk, but it's over phone once a week.
Right,
So,
okay. Yeah.
So, yeah, trying to approach that, too, I guess.
Yeah. Thank you.
But thanks for the suggestion.
You're welcome.
In addition to the support and resources in terms of the counseling and talk, financial resources that are available to staff if they're out for 2 or 3 weeks or a month while they're getting that assistance, if it's an hourly employee that's dependent on those wages, so that they don't continue to kind of spiral down. What is appropriate that we can continue to support as a small business that doesn't offer official benefits? Is it appropriate to go to other employees or tip pools if they have that idea? Or what are some options or opportunities to continue to support them while they are accessing those great resources and therapy and doctor's appointments?
Yeah, so small business, again, is very tricky because we don't have all those amazing benefits that we get when we work for bigger companies. I know when I worked in a previous job and it was a small business, it's really about what is the company capable of doing. What is, at the end of the day, whether it be they offer those accommodations. And I think that is very much the challenge when you're working for a small business, that you don't have access to the benefits that would make dealing with a mental health or a physical situation, because you don't have access to short-term or long-term disability. I would say, I'm just like thinking about our business, not to put my husband on the spot, and thankfully we haven't had to deal with that, but I think as owners, our employees are very important to us. We value each and every one of them, and we would do what we need to do to make sure that we can retain them and support them through that. My husband's saying we'd offer vacation time. So again, it has to do with, what is the company culture and who's in charge and calling the shots and whatnot. And again, in a previous job, I had a friend who ended up getting cancer at 28, and the company that we worked for took amazing care of her. Because again, we didn't have PTO and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And so she was very well taken care of. But that is one of the challenges, I think, oftentimes when working for small business.
Yeah, and for these, it's hourly employees, it's not a salaried position, and we're obviously keeping those shifts available for when this employee is ready to come back.
That's great.
That person financially is reliant on that hourly wage and those tips. So wanting to make sure that they can still kind of sustain.
Right, and that's,
to come back and maybe
one of the things you talked about, like tip pools and things like that, is really, if you have a positive organizational culture, people step up. If it's every man for themselves, you're not going to see
dog
that.
Dog,
but
yeah.
Really, when you cultivate a really positive organizational culture. The other thing is learning your community resources, because there are amazing community resources. So, you know, food banks and things like that, so that they're not, like, stressing out about that. You know, the electric company, what kind of resources do they have to kind of waive fees or postpone that? So really learning what your community has to offer is real, real important.
And the community that you, like, the people that are coming in, that's our community, too. Any other? Okay, we're done.
Jacqueline and Cindy, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Give it up.